This is Build and Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, and mobile web development. The show is hosted by Marco Arment. He is the creator, the founder of Instapaper.com, among other things. I'm Dan Benjamin. We would like to say a quick thank you to our two sponsors, the Omni Group and Harvest. I'd also like to mention that Bandwidth has been provided by Midas Green Technologies. Virtual private servers submerged in oil. Seriously, check them out at MidasGreenTech.com. Marco, you were just saying off the air before we started that you have nothing. You've got nothing. You're just going to talk about the AeroPress the whole show.
Pretty much. I mean, the AeroPress is awesome. And, you know, everyone keeps asking me how exactly I use it. Like, how, you know, what recipe do I use? Because there's like this whole movement to use it upside down.
Now, I was kidding, but you're going to do this.
Yeah. or to like use the metal filter that you can get. I use mine right side up. I boil the water, even though it says to use 175 degree water. I tried the metal filter. I don't actually like it. It does let through a lot of sediment, like a French press.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the last sip is full of coffee grounds, basically. And one of the big benefits of the AeroPress is that it doesn't do that. Usually it's going through a paper filter, which keeps out all of the sediment. So you have a nice clean cup. So the metal filter is kind of is a step backwards in that regard. Now, I imagine what I'm supposed to do probably is use a bigger grind size with it. But if I do that, then I will lose another one of the AeroPress's great benefits, which is you can use a really fine grind and get a lot of flavor out of it. So I think the metal filter is probably more for people who want this to be like a French press, possibly that's just easier to clean up. For me, I really prefer the regular AeroPress method. And so what I do, I put in about 9 or 10 grams of coffee, and then to make like one mug. And then I pour the water in, boiling, to between like the 2 and the 3. Let it soak for about 10 seconds. Stir it with a spoon for about 10 seconds. Let it sit for about 10 more seconds. And then push down on the plunger pretty hard all the way to the bottom, even though it says push moderately. And then I add maybe 20% more water to dilute it, depending on how strong the flavor is and what I'm going to move for. And that's it. And then I drink it.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds like a lot, you know, that's a lot. That's a lot of,
it's a lot of clarification and elaboration on what is actually a very simple process. Once you do it, it's pour, soak 10 seconds, stir 10 seconds, wait 10 seconds,
right.
Push.
So you're boiling water for 8 minutes
So when I said 8 minutes before, that was a high estimate. That was including, like, if you have to go get the water out of a well and bring it back in a bucket.
No.
Bring it up 10 flights of stairs. I mean, normally this takes me, I checked, it's closer to like 5 or 6 minutes total. And most of that time is just waiting for the water to boil. If you have an electric kettle or something that boils it really fast, you'd probably do it in even less time than that.
So it's more about how long it takes it to boil. But you did. I mean, for the record, you did say it 8 minutes.
Right, that was an estimate. I wasn't actually paying attention. And then since that point, I've started paying attention. So it's been, now I've been better informed about what exactly it is that I'm doing every morning.
Hmm.
So now I'm properly caffeinated for the show, as you request.
And, yes, that's important to me that you are caffeinated. I mean, you're much more, and you'll be impressed. I'm actually drinking some high-end coffee today, too. It's your favorite from your favorite place.
Oh, yeah? Is it from a popular, supposedly Seattle-based reseller of coffee beverages?
Or yeah, I'm not sure. Faith brought it in. She's in the studio, by the way, but she brought it in, and it's got it's got like a big mermaid on it. It's all about mermaid.
So you know how on American cheese, they can't actually call it cheese because by some technical definition, by food standards, it isn't cheese. So they have to call it pasteurized processed cheese food. And I think
the kind of
coffee that comes from that vendor with the green mermaid logo, I think that should be called something similar. It should be called something like coffee-inspired beverage product.
Because what you're saying is that it's not real. It's not the real deal. Somehow it's insulting to you.
Yeah,
that I would have this.
It has been complicated, and it is very far removed in most cases from what coffee really is outside of that world and what it's supposed to be. So I'm going with coffee inspired beverage product.
This is pretty good though. This is what she got. And every morning every morning she says, "Tell what do you want from Starbucks on her way in?" I guess you pass one, Faith. So if she comes right by it, she grabs it, she brings it in.
Yeah,
I have no complaints. Right, this is way better than that Keurig thing that I've been using. This is like, I'm still drinking it. She brought this at 8, 9 in the morning. I'm still drinking it.
Tell you what, you're in Austin. Go to the Hideout Theater to get a breakfast taco, even though it's wrapped in something you probably don't eat. Cause it's
if they can do corn tortilla, I can do it.
I think it's flour normally, but you could ask. They might have corn. I don't know. You're in Texas. They probably have everything. But
I'll
tell
you, you know where I like the best coffee I've had here? Marco, the best coffee I've had here so far has been this Austin Java.
Oh, I never went there. Is that near downtown?
They've got two of them. They've got one out like in the Barton Creek area, and then they've got another one somewhere. I don't know. I don't go to that one.
So Lion's out.
Yeah, maybe we should talk about some of this stuff because this has been a pretty big week for Apple.
It has. And, you know, I think so. For the last 2 weeks, we've been ending the show with like a 20-minute geek fest on Apple's computers and what computer you should get for your portable needs. And we were speculating about the new MacBook Airs, and those are now out. So I do want to discuss that, even though it's, you know, I'm always torn on whether this is developer related, because there's a lot of people who don't develop on Macs, although I think that number is getting smaller. But you know, that's certainly the case. A lot of people don't develop on Macs and aren't writing iOS software or aren't even Mac fans. And somehow they can tolerate listening to our show where we are clearly major Mac fans all the time.
Yeah.
So I don't want to go too much into that yet. I think we'll do the same thing at the end of the show about what just happened in the Apple computer lineup.
Yeah.
But I think it is worth talking about Lion. And there's lots of reasons for that, but I think if you read John Siracusa's review, even if you are not a Mac fan, I think you should read it.
It's long. I get it. I mean, it's 85 pages.
Print it out.
Print it. But don't you print the internet
what,
19, when you need to read it?
Right. Yeah, it's 19 pages on their site. And
right,
actually, to give them credit, this is on Ars Technica, and to give them credit, the page breaks are actually put in by John Siracusa, the author.
So he controls that. He's aware of where they're breaking it. That's what you're
saying. Separates the sections. And so it actually does make sense there, I think. Now, I read the whole thing. I signed up for the subscription thing, and I read the whole thing in one big single page view in one long sitting in Instapaper on my iPad. Yeah. But if you're a regular human being and you don't want to read the whole thing in one big sitting, I think the pages actually make sense.
Yeah.
Then you can say, all right, I'm on page 14, and I'll come back after dinner.
Now, let me. So, Faith is a regular person. She's not a. I mean, she's interested in this stuff, but she's a.
This is going to be painful for
she's
her.
She's a real human being. Okay.
So sorry.
She's a regular human being, and she has a real life outside of this stuff. Whereas, like, you and I think about this, and.
I don't even know what that means.
No, I don't either. And I try to ask her. Go ahead. No, what are you going to say?
I don't know what that means. I would be curious to hear what that means.
What this means is that, like, at the end of the day, you leave and you're not still thinking about Lion or Max or whatever. You're like doing something else. Whereas the most of us that are listening to this and talk, certainly the two of us who are talking now, when we leave, we continue to think about this stuff. Like that's actually interesting. It's on our list of things like we like thinking about it. So this is the thing. Faith, there's an 85-page review of this new version of Mac OS X that just came out that my friend, co-host of Hypercritical, John Siracusa wrote. It's 85. If you print this review that he wrote of it, it's 85 pages. That seems long, right? I mean, that's long.
That's incredibly long.
Yeah. So you read this whole thing, Marco?
Yeah, it took me probably about an hour and a half.
That's it? This is the thing. This is a problem, and I'm going to talk about it. I want to get your opinion on this. I'm hoping you agree with me because we generally agree in larger concepts, but in details it could be different. This is what I want to ask you. When you see those links in there, don't you feel obligated to mouse over them and see where they're going to go or potentially click them? I mean, I know you said you read this on the iPad, but do you find that to be distracting? Do you need everything to be linked? Because some links, I'm afraid that some links are going to be important and other links are not going to be important. And how do you know which one to click? How do you know which one to... Maybe I should click them all. Do I open them in a new tab? What if I'm reading it on an iPad? Then you get the little animation thing.
I opened almost none of them But I did do the hover thing, which in Instapaper, you just tap on a link and it shows like a little popover with the preview telling you what the URL is.
Right.
So that's what I did. So I previewed most of them until I started getting the hang of which ones I didn't need to even bother that with. and so I like, because that's part of the content. Like it, you can, you know, the way that he wrote it, you know that he actually considered this. This isn't like those stupid double underlined green links that show ad hubs.
The worst.
Web pages. Those are horrible. It's
the
not
worst.
Like that.
I hate those things.
Like those are just inserted by robots. So there's no reason to go anywhere near them, and you better keep your mouse pointer away from them because they'll pop up and then you get, and it'll load, and it'll, if you have Flash, it'll crash your browser and all sorts of fun stuff. So that this isn't like that. This is like the author put these links in.
Right. So they mean something.
In a sensible fashion, intentionally to mean something. Now, a lot of times, you don't even need to click on it to see the meaning. You just need to see where it goes. So if it's something like a Wikipedia article or even like a YouTube video, like you can see the YouTube URL, you're like, oh, okay, I'm sure it links to a funny video. And you don't even have to follow. Sorry, John.
Yeah.
I never watch videos. But so, you know, if the links are part of the content, but they're more like footnotes in that they're in theory an optional part of the
right,
content.
Right, like you could omit them, you could not click any of the links and you would still be all right. Right. You'd be okay.
Like, geeks like us care a lot about reading every little thing in these things that we enjoy. But if you're only a little bit into this and you don't care that much to read every single word or to get every single link reference, you can skip over the links, like not look at them, and you'd still be fine. You'd still get the gist of the story. So I think treat them like footnotes. If you're the kind of person who reads every single footnote in everything that you read, then you're probably going to want that. But you know, in this case, you know, you don't need to see every link. Anyway, so in this review, he talks about a lot of the changes in Lion's abilities when using supported document-based apps. The biggest ones are autosave, automatic versioning, and resume, I think. So this is the area where Lion is going to be awesome once most or all of your apps that you use on a regular basis are adjusted to support it.
Hmm.
And this is going to be easier for a lot of apps than others. So basically, if the app was written in a fairly modern fashion using Cocoa, using especially if it uses NS Document, or you know, if it's using modern conventions, Apple's modern conventions of the APIs and everything else, then it will get a lot of this Lion stuff either for free or for almost no work. But the programmer still has to do it. They still have to turn it on. Like they have to build for Lion and they have to, you know, make sure these features work. And I don't know the details because I'm not a Mac programmer, but they're going to have to update their software to work with Lion and with all of its cool new stuff like this.
Sure.
Now, so that's all extremely beneficial. Like the concept of not worrying about an app crashing or closing the app and losing all your stuff because you didn't save it. I mean, how many times have you had to painfully tell a novice user that that document that they had opened for an hour that disappeared when their computer had a power failure or the computer or the program crashed or anything like that, or there's a kernel panic, like all that work that they hadn't been hitting Control or Command S for constantly? Like I'm a geek. I hit Command S constantly. But all that work that most people do, and they save like when they remember to or when they close the document, they could lose hours of work,
right?
Because of the lack of autosave, or something that even bit me just yesterday. So Lion's out. I haven't installed it yet on my desktop because I'm in the middle of a big project and I want to finish that first. So just yesterday, I was caught by another very common problem, which is, you're closing a program for some reason, whether you need to restart or whatever, you're closing a program. And you have a few windows open. And maybe one of them is like a scratch pad window or, you know, like a temporary thing you opened up. So the box comes up and says, do you wish to save your unsaved changes in this document? And you think, oh, it's the scratch pad. I don't need those. So you hit don't save. But it was actually a different window. You didn't look closely enough. They were asking you about a different document that you actually did want to save. There is no way to undo that
yeah.
in Snow Leopard and in any any app made up until yesterday. There is no way to undo that action. That data is just gone. If it was unsaved, it's gone. And you told it, don't save, but most things you tell a computer to do, there's an easy undo for. That's one where there isn't one. In Lion, it won't even have to ask you whether it wants to save things. It'll just close. And next time you open the program, it'll have everything in the state it was in before. So it'll have your unsaved changes still sitting there, still conceptually unsaved, even though they are technically saved in a way. There's all these little changes like that. And then in the chat, they mentioned sandboxing. This is another big thing. Currently, the user security model on all modern Unix computers, as far as I know, and I think even on Windows, is that anything that runs, any apps that run as the user, so any apps that you launch basically when you're logged in, they have read and write access to your entire home directory. So that means every file you've ever saved, every document, all of your music, all of your photos, every file that's yours that you've saved on your computer, if you download a program and run it from the internet, it has access to not only read all that stuff, which is enough of a problem, but also to delete it or to change it or to move it. And you know, a pretty good principle of security is you give things only the permission and the ability to do what they need to do and no more than that. I think it's called least privilege or something. There's some good word for it. And so what Lion is doing, and this is important because they've decreed, this happened during WWDC, and I don't think we were allowed to talk about it, but I think now we can. Apple basically said, they did say that if you submit an app to the Mac App Store by November, it has to be sandboxed. And so Lion has this new sandboxing framework where apps have to explicitly say what permissions they need on the system. And they can't just read all your files anymore. They can't just open connections behind your back to the internet anymore, like for tracking purposes or anything like that. They can only do what they have permission to do. And as part of the app review process for the Mac App Store, Apple is looking through those permissions that apps are requesting and seeing, you know, do they really reasonably need that permission? And they'll reject an app if it says, like, you know, like your disk burning software shouldn't need an internet connection. But if they submit something to the Mac App Store, Apple will reject it saying, you know, you don't really need this, so you need to remove this or provide a really good reason why you need it. So this whole thing is a massive revolution in computer security, I think. This is a really big deal. And it's going to be a while before everything that you use is sandboxed. But one of the best things, like John Siracusa said in his review, is even if an app itself wasn't written to be malicious, if there's some kind of buffer overflow vulnerability or some other kind of hack to the app where there's some security problem that the authors didn't patch, even a compromised app can do a lot less of potential harm than it could before. So like if some virus is written to take advantage of some Word macro virus or whatever the modern version of that is. Like if Word doesn't have the ability to delete files, then that virus can't delete files. So like there's all sorts of little benefits like that that they've written in here. So that it's going to be a huge deal. And I think, you know, you can look in the past and you can see with all the discussion around Mac security versus Windows and viruses and malware, most of what you see is the Mac is safe because it isn't a big target. And I think we've talked about that before and whether or not that's true or not, but this, and there are a lot of ways that the Mac is designed to be pretty safe and, you know, to be somewhat resistant towards things like viruses and malware. But once sandboxing is in full effect, once all of the applications that you use are sandboxed, which is probably not that far off, then Macs really are a lot safer than Windows machines. Because then like the ability for software to do anything is very limited. So that's actually a big deal. And I think the Mac Defender scare kind of kicked Apple's butt a bit in the scheduling of this. Like, I think that's why they're being so aggressive. To say that all App Store apps need to be sandboxed by November is pretty aggressive. And I think that helped. I think that's they're kind of getting a jump on this, because what they don't want is right now, during this transition period where a lot of this extra security isn't in full force yet, they don't want there to be some huge Mac virus or malware. Because Mac Defender was almost that, and it got them a lot of bad press, and it probably really hurt Mac sales in the sense that a lot of people flee Windows and go to Macs to avoid all that stuff. And so if there's like one major attack on the Mac where people's opinion or where people's image of that gets shattered a bit, or where people start hearing from their friends, oh, there's this big Mac virus, that ruins a lot of the reason to buy a Mac for a lot of normal people who aren't us. And so all the security that they can get in place, I think they're rushing. They want to get this in place as quickly as possible to avoid something like that happening, or at least to minimize the chances of it happening, and then to minimize the damage that something can do if it does happen. So all this is saying Lion's a really big deal, but possibly not quite yet. Like, all of the features and all of the document saving and the autosave and the versions and the restore state and safe termination, all these great things, they require the apps to support them before they really matter. And in the case of the malware prevention, even that, sandboxing helps a lot of it, but as long as you can still run apps that aren't from the App Store, or at least as long as apps not from the App Store will run by default, then that's still a problem too. So yeah, my point is that most of the stuff with Lion is going to be really cool once everything supports it. But that might be a while. Like, my text editor of choice currently, TextMate, is probably not going to support any of this new cool stuff until it's long fabled version 2.0, which I've been told since last episode when we were talking about this.
Yeah, we get a lot of feedback on that.
Yeah, and a lot of people have pointed out that Macromates actually is responding to people asking about TextMate 2, basically just saying they're working on it, but they have nothing to announce right now.
Hmm.
The problem is they've been saying that exact same thing for like 5 years or something. It's been crazy how long they've been saying that.
Yeah. Our first sponsor today is the Omni Group, makers of productivity applications exclusively for Mac OS X, iPhone, and iPad. These guys are known for their awesome software, gold standard customer support, and palpable geekery. OmniFocus is designed to quickly capture your thoughts and allow you to store, manage, and process them into actionable to-do items. It's perfect for the getting things done system, but flexible enough for any task management style. It's one of my absolute favorite task management apps. I want you guys to try it. You can organize your stuff by phone calls, emails, errands. You can use projects to help define actions that are related. It's really up to you. You can come up with your own organizational methodology, or you can use one of the systems that exist out there. It's totally compatible. You can even keep your data up to date wherever you go by syncing over a local network or the cloud using MobileMe or standard web dev server. Now, OmniFocus is available today for the Mac, iPhone, and iPad. Check it out at omnigroup.com and, of course, in iTunes and the App Store. It's everywhere. Check it out. OmniGroup makes it. OmniFocus. It's awesome.
Suppose that Snow Leopard, which came out a year and a half ago, right? Or just a year ago?
I think it was about a year. I think it was like, wasn't it July of a year ago? What does the chat room say about that?
Anyway.
They'll tell us.
Suppose that Snow Leopard had some great new feature like autosave and versioning and all that stuff that Lion has. And TextMate at that point said, oh, well, we'll support it with 2.0. Well, if you sat around waiting for that to happen, you'd still be sitting around waiting a whole new version later.
Yeah.
Because there has not been a significant feature upgrade to TextMate in a very long time. And we said last week, I was saying how, like, this supposed to keep meaning to write, software is a service. And when you're committed to working with a particular program, that, like, that's your tool. That's really important, that it's always there, that it works. And the fact is, computers move forward. So even if this tool works great today, there's going to be a change at some point. Like, For instance, what if Apple does start requiring everything to be sold through the Mac App Store? And, you know, adding sandboxing and all that stuff is going to be a bit of work for TextMate.
Well, speaking of the store, meanwhile, BB Edit 10 just drops.
Right, which is in the store, by the way.
Yeah, it is in the store. And then what a fortuitous time to be dropping in the store and to have you, hey, look, number 10, brand new version. This, for a lot of people, Vinny Rose in the chat room, among others, is saying, yeah, I've given up on TextMate 2. I actually think this could be really good for BB Edit, for the people who aren't using it, that, you know, maybe now is when they're going to switch.
Oh, yeah.
And it's $40. That's cheap for this app. This app used to be a lot more than that.
Yeah, I think it used to be $150, right?
Yeah, I think so.
At least recently, I think it was still $100. So that's pretty good. $40. I mean, that's great.
That seems too cheap.
And
yeah, there's that. Yeah, a golfer says it was $120.
Okay, whatever. I think this is a really good time for BB Edit because they just made a new update, right as a lot of people are starting to really ask questions about TextMate. Like, we haven't heard about TextMate 2 in so long. And, you know, one argument is TextMate 1 works. Mm. And it's true. I use it every single day. It does work. But there are a lot of little annoyances. So I'll go through a few of them here because one guy emailed us asking basically, well, what's wrong with it? And I thought that was a good question. So one of the biggest problems with it, I think, is the find in project. And there are plugins that you can get that a lot of people love that replace the find panel or the find in project panel with something faster and better and everything. I've tried a few of them. They've all been buggy as hell, and I haven't liked them very much. But somebody recommended, I think it's called Akin Project, so I'm going to try that next.
Yeah, you got to try Akin. Akin Project is super, super fast.
Is it better?
Way better.
I think I tried something called Akmate in the past. Is that a thing? I think I tried Akmate, and it was extremely buggy.
Hmm.
And so I switched back. But yeah, so the find window, it's single-threaded. It's slow. So if you want to do a find in project for any substring, you're going to be sitting there watching the beach ball. The whole program will be frozen for at least a few seconds, possibly more. And the single-threadedness of the program has a few other implications. Like if you paste in a very long line accidentally from maybe a binary file or something, I think it's trying to syntax highlight it. But whatever the reason, TextMate will sit there and beach ball for minutes at a time sometimes, or it'll just crash. Or it'll beach ball for so long that you'll just give up and force quit it, making it crash, because you figure it probably will never recover in any reasonable amount of time. Same thing happens if you open not just long lines, but if you open a long file. Like if you accidentally open up a log file or anything very, very big, like more than a meg or so of text, it'll sit there beach balling forever and probably crash. And because it doesn't support any kind of autosave of untitled or unsaved documents, then you lose anything you have in a window that's not saved. And so if you have like a couple of like scratch windows open that are just untitled, you lose all that stuff every time the program crashes. So it's annoying. A bigger problem, even if you fix find and replace, and even if you never paste in long stuff, a problem I run into all the time is that syntax highlighting and sensibility is kind of dumb in it. It's kind of easy to fool. So like the example I gave in the response to this email, sorry, I forgot the guy's name, but I'm like, you know, recently I had a thing where I was writing a parser that had to check to see if a character was an opening parenthesis. And if you say, you know, is C equal or if C equals opening parenthesis in quotes, it isn't smart enough to know that's a string literal. And so it'll count that parenthesis as an open one in the block structure of the code.
Right.
Like it's little things that it's just very dumb about. Or like if you have a mixed language document, like if you're editing a PHP file that outputs HTML and JavaScript, so that's three languages in one file, or four if you include CSS, like it won't properly detect the JavaScript block or one of the HTML blocks. So like it's very, very easy to hit the limits of the syntax highlighter. And then other things, like I would love to have a decent IntelliSense type code suggestion drop down thing. And all that stuff doesn't exist either in TextMate as far as I know. Maybe there are add-ons to do it. But So like the TextMate 1 code base actually is not working for me in these few ways. And so I really think I'm going to give VBEdit a real shot here because I'm just so tired of having nothing happening in TextMate. And, you know, people can say, oh, well, they say they're working on it. That's true. But that's been the case for so long, we have no idea if there's even an end in sight. And so, yes, they've been working on it. That's what's kept us here so long.
But right.
I kind of feel like an idiot for having waited this long.
And don't you feel like the longer that you stay with it, the more married you become to it and the less you can tease your life away from it?
Yeah, I mean that's kind of dramatic, but yes.
Well, I mean think about it. Like every day you're investing time. It's right, it's exactly. Like, you know, this infrastructure that you wrote that you use for PHP that's behind the scenes and you're pretty much married to that. You could switch it out, but every new bit of code, every improvement that you make, you're continuing down the line. Well, the editor you use, you almost feel like that too, because you're building muscle memory, you're building a whole lot. There's a huge, and that's the thing, is that whatever it is, whatever the app is that you use to create the things you create every day, that's a big deal. You know, a lot of the time, like you'll see, you know, and this is funny. I was talking to somebody that used to drive a UPS truck, and they were saying that after you spend enough time in the UPS truck, like everything becomes automatic. The way that you unbuckle and buckle your seatbelt, and the way that you have to, you know, get out of the UPS truck, like the movements that you take to do the steps and everything, like this kind of stuff seems silly, but like they actually rate you on that kind of performance, and they rate you on that kind of stuff. So having it integrated that way and having that kind of performance, like it's important. But the same thing is there when you try to switch editors. Like let's say you say, you know, forget TextMate. This is done. I'm done. I'm giving up. And you go to use BBEdit. Even though BBEdit is great, you're not going to be familiar. You're not going to have those keystrokes. You're not going to have those commands. You're not going to have those other things at your disposal. So, right. You know, you're going to think, like, immediately your muscle memory will say this app sucks. Even if it has all the features you want, you won't know where they are, and you'll be like, you'll be starting from square one again.
Right. I mean, it's an issue of fluency. You're really talking about fluency. It's like when you are fluent with a tool, you don't need to think about using it. You just use it. And you don't need to think in your head where the menu items are or what the keyboard command is. You just do it. Like you just will it to be done, and your muscle memory just does it. And you know, there's a lot of parallels here to Xcode 4. When that came out, we had a good episode about old versions and like clinging to old versions of things, and why ultimately you shouldn't expect that you can always use an old version forever.
Right.
So, you know, Xcode 4, like when you go from 3 to 4, if you haven't yet, I think now you kind of have to, because I think it's pretty wonky to try to run 3 on Lion, but. Mm-hmm. You know, when you go from 3 to 4, it's a big change. And so if you're in the middle of a big project, like I am right now, it's a terrible time to do that. There's never a good time to replace a critical tool and incur a learning curve, because all the work that you have to put into learning the new version, working around its limitations or finding its limitations, and, you know, working around any bugs it has and retraining yourself with these new commands or new places for things, all of that incurs a cost on you that you have to spend your time and or money doing that when you're not making your product better. It's really a tax. It's like you have to just incur this cost for the moment, not a major upside to you, unless, you know, the new features could be really cool, but, you know, it comes at a cost, right? And so changing your text editor is a major switch. It's going to involve tons of retraining, tons of, you know, slowed down work. It's going to significantly impair your ability to work for a while. And, you know, it's not going to prevent you from working, but it's going to slow you down. And so, you know, for me, this is a terrible time to switch. But unless you have a really boring job where, you know, you work for some big company and you don't need to do much and you can waste a lot of time all day, most people will never have a good time to switch. Like, when is that ever going to happen? When can you say, you know what? I don't have anything to do for the next month.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, a lot of people never get that chance. And then the problem that you have is at some point you are forced to switch. You know, whether something breaks and it's not being updated anymore,
right?
Or a new version of something critical comes out that doesn't work with your old version of something else. You know, at some point, if you're holding on to an old version of something or an unmaintained version of something, at some point, it's going to break. And that might be next month or it might be 10 years from now. But at some point, the break will happen, and then you have to do the switch and incur all the switching costs at a random time that you didn't get to choose.
So the point is, these tools are the ones that are not being updated, the ones that are not moving along. Now this is a wake up call for them. In the past, you could say, "Oh well, we'll come out with a fix for Snow Leopard and everything will just work." But now what you're saying, if I'm hearing you right, is that there are these critical features that you absolutely have to have because people are going to come to use the computer in a whole different way. You're going to feel like you can shut the computer down without saving anything. And you're not going to get prompted. Apps are just going to close. They're going to do the right thing. And when you turn it on again, they're going to be right back where you left them. Everything's just going to work. And this has become, it's going to become ubiquitous. Whether that's in a week or a month or a year, at some point in time soon, all of the apps that you care about are going to work this way. And yes, you know what? Maybe there are going to be special case applications. An example might be, you know, some audio editing app that you must have or some video
Photoshop.
Editing or Photoshop or whatever, that's just not going to work that way. It's not going to play along. It's not going to be nice. Fine. You know, right. It's going to have its own thing. All right. But the apps that are what we think of as everyday apps, I would almost put the text editor, even though it is a special app, I would almost put it in that category, one that you expect to work this way. So now it's not like, well, they've added new features of Snow Leopard and you're not going to take advantage of them. They've changed the way that people are going to use the operating system in this way that is so much better that developers need to pay attention to this and need to just add this capability to their app so that it just works. And if they don't do that, they're going to get left behind. TextMate is going to get left behind. It's already left behind, but now this is like the nail in the coffin, right?
It's certainly going to hurt because, you know, right now the instances in which I lose data because of a shortcoming in TextMate are moderately frequent. You know, maybe once a month I'll have a kernel panic, which admittedly is not TextMate's fault. It's because my Mac Pro is out of warranty. And as soon as that happened, I started getting kernel panics once a month. But, you know, whenever I run into a shortcoming, like there wasn't an autosave, or it crashes because I pasted in a line that was too long, or I open up a file that's too big, or something like that, all of these problems today are relatively infrequent. But you're right. Like, as I get accustomed in Lion to trusting that things will resume the state they were in when I close them next time I open them, and knowing that TextMate won't do that, I think it's going to start causing me to accidentally lose data more often because my expectations have changed, and I will assume, oh, everything saves, and then I'll forget, oh, wait, except TextMate.
Mm.
And so it's going to be a rough transition because this is going to be a problem for a lot of people, especially like for the big apps like Photoshop and Microsoft Office. You know, anything from Adobe, anything from Microsoft, they probably will add this stuff eventually, but they're going to really drag their feet on it, I bet. And like somebody said, I think it was on Twitter sometime recently. So Adobe posted this page of like known incompatibilities or issues with their products on Lion. And somebody on Twitter, I think, said it looks like they've never even tried the betas. Like the whole point of the beta, giving the beta to developers, the whole point is that developers can prepare their apps. If there's anything wrong, anything that's different, or any new thing they want to add support for, or any incompatibility they weren't expecting. That's the whole point, is so that they have months to find and fix these issues. And it looks like Adobe didn't even try. I mean, I'm sure that's not true. I'm sure they did. But like the attitude they're showing sounds a lot like they didn't even... Like,
right.
Lions caught them totally by surprise. They had no idea what it was like and what would be broken. And now they're rushing to try to fix these problems. it's ridiculous. I don't like Adobe. You know,
no, that's coming across.
I, I bought two copies of Photoshop, one for me and one for my wife. We both use it for our work.
Hmm.
And I bought Lightroom as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
so for not liking Adobe, you sure are supporting them.
Well, here's the thing. Again, ask photographers and ask people who edit photos. Like, the reason I bought Photoshop for myself, even though I'm not in it all the time, it's open right now. I don't even know what's in it. I don't want to open it, but it's running right now. I have Photoshop open almost all the time. My wife does all of her work in Photoshop and Bridge. She's a photographer. For the reason I bought it is because I don't have time to learn a new image editor for the things I do with it. Like, I use it to adjust graphics while programming or while blogging or just little things I need, little icon tweaks, whatever the case, editing an alpha mask, whatever the case may be. I know how to do these things in Photoshop. And the last thing I want is to, next time I need something like that, to have it take 3 hours while I learn a new program. You know, because right now, like, something that would take me 5 minutes in Photoshop. So similarly, like, and Lightroom is a different story. I got Lightroom because Aperture was slow and buggy and crunchy.
Yeah, are you in the light squarely in the Lightroom camp?
No.
No.
I use it, but I don't like it that much. I did like it more. I've actually recently been wanting to switch back to iPhoto, which sounds weird, I bet, to most people, but
no, it doesn't. Right now, it doesn't at all. It doesn't sound weird to me. I've actually been switching back to it too.
Oh, really? That's good.
Yeah. Okay. No, I thought it was weird, and then the more people I would mention it to, the more they'd say, "Oh no, I'm doing that too." Like, it sounds weird, but tell me why you're doing that.
The main reason is I found two problems. One is that most pictures I take for myself now are taken with my iPhone, and so all of the power of the raw, lossless editing, the reason I switched to Aperture and then to Lightroom,
right,
is mostly being wasted on me now because I'm just using my phone to take casual pictures of, you know, things I see outside that are funny, or my family, or my dog. Like, I'm not taking a lot of SLR pictures myself anymore, except when I'm working with a photography gig with my wife. So that's not really a problem for me anymore. And then I found that the workflow is so heavy with these pro editing programs. They're so slow. They're so massive to launch. The import is more steps, and it's such a heavy process that I hardly ever do it. I'm actually taking fewer photos, I think, because the process is so bad. It's just so heavy. It's obviously optimized for pro type uses, but that isn't how I'm using it anymore. And then the other problem is, since I'm using Lightroom and not Aperture or iPhoto, I never have photos synced well to my devices.
Exactly.
That's a huge problem. Like, I'll take a photo of my dog that's adorable 2 weeks ago. It's not on my phone anymore because I had to delete it to make space. And I would have put it in an album and had it give me a shrunk version and you know, synced over with iPhoto with albums and stuff, but I can't do that. I have to use Lightroom. Or I am using Lightroom. And the way to have Lightroom sync to an iPhone or iPad is very manual and fairly crappy. And you basically have to make a smart publishing.
I still can't believe you got a dog.
Honestly, I love having a dog. I don't regret it at all. So you were wrong on that one. But
we'll see.
you were right on the grill, that the grill is awesome. But, so I find that I never have the photos with me that I want to have with me. Like, I have a 64 gig iPad. I could sync all my photos to that, obviously.
But you know, how much, here's the thing. So Marco, this is where I've kind of come from on this. I switched over to Lightroom. I actually got both Lightroom and Aperture when they first came out and wound up kind of going down the Lightroom path and sticking there. Although I do like Aperture, and I think the latest version of Aperture is by far leaps and bounds better than the last one, though I'm still,
they all said that.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, I think this one is really functionality wise, especially I've talked to some professional photographers about it, and they really seem to think that Lightroom and Aperture really right now really are on par, and it's just a preference thing. And for a while, I don't think they were. I think Lightroom was just way ahead. But I'm with you. I feel like, you know, unless you're really doing a ton of image editing. And again, I got the digital SLR. First I had the D700 and then that was overkill for me. So I sold it and went down to the D90. And sure, I mean, you're taking these great photographs, but I always sort of imagined that I'd be in there like just making them perfect and doing all kinds of, and really all I'm doing is just offloading them just the same way that I was doing right. in iPhoto. Once in a while, you want to get some prints made. And really there isn't very much that you can't do in iPhoto that, you know, for somebody like me, like it, I just feel like Lightroom, it's like, it's, you know, you talked about Photoshop before. It's like getting Photoshop to make a very, very simple graphic or just type some text into something. You can do that with a much less expensive application that is going to cost much less money. And iPhoto, I think it's great. Isn't it great?
Yeah. I mean, well, I haven't,
it's awesome.
I haven't used it full time since, I guess iPhoto 08 or like somewhere around whatever version was around in 08. Like that was the last version I used. Like I still haven't used face recognition, because that came out right after I stopped using iPhoto, which was hilarious too, because then, like, you know, iPhoto gets all these cool features that I actually could have some use for either way before they come to Aperture and or Lightroom, or they never come to Aperture and Lightroom.
Right.
and now I think, like, with iCloud coming up soon, with the photo stream syncing and all this, I just feel like I want to be back in the consumer space where I probably belong with my current usage. Also, something to think about. One of the biggest reasons I used Aperture and Lightroom was not because of their management and library features, which I think is a big reason why a lot of people use them.
Yeah, for sure. Especially when you have like millions of pictures.
Right. I didn't care about that stuff. The reasons I used them were for the lossless raw editing.
Right.
Now, it turns out the way iPhoto does it, iPhoto does do raw editing. It doesn't do it straight to JPEG, and then, like, if you want to adjust exposure or white balance, like, it isn't operating on the JPEG the first time. So when you edit a photo in iPhoto, the first time you edit it, it has a little raw badge in the corner. And when you're doing that, when you're doing adjustments to that, they actually are lossless raw adjustments, just like Aperture would do it. And then once you save those changes, then it saves a JPEG. And then future improvements you do on that photo are done with the JPEG version as the base. But you can always revert back to the RAW
That's
and redo
really
those adjustments losslessly from the beginning again.
I did not know that.
So it actually is pretty good in that respect. Like, it's, I think that's close enough.
It's even more ammunition for me to use this thing now.
Right. So I think ultimately that's what I have to do is switch back. And that's yet another thing that it's not a priority for me because my photos aren't currently on fire and nothing is broken, but like I never sync them. It's just such a pain right now. And I just feel like if I move, you know, in the Apple computing world, the closer you do things to what Apple considers the majority case and like the consumer path, the closer you follow that with your usage, the easier it is, because and usually the better it is, because Apple will give you features first, and you'll get like all this stuff, like the face recognition came there first, and the map, and all this stuff.
Second sponsor today is one I absolutely love to talk about: Harvest. They're a time tracking and invoicing web-based application. They serve the most creative and innovative businesses in over 100 countries worldwide. These guys are big time. It's a really the essence of what Harvest is. It's a really fast way to track time and keep track of your personal budget. So you can send your clients beautiful invoices. You can do it via email or PDF or on the web, but you can also accept online credit card and check payments. There's a free companion iPhone and Android app. You can track time and expenses with these things on the go. And you can take pictures of your receipts and you upload them straight in the app. It's the coolest thing ever. Integrations are there for your favorite small business apps like Google Apps and Basecamp, you name it. They're integrating with it. It's super cool. And here's something great. You can try it free for 30 days. You will discover how it can make your work better and how it will help you grow your business in 2011. Now, there's no credit card, no obligations, none of that stuff. You just go to getharvest.com/5x5. Let me say that again so that you shall never forget it. Getharvest.com/5x5. You sign up, you'll get a free 30-day trial. And after your initial trial period, use the code 5x5TV, all one word, at checkout. And you will get, this is crazy, 50% off your first month. You got to do this before June 1st. That's the only catch. But you need to do it. So go there, do it, check it out, getharvest.com. There are even things, Marco, where you, where you'll run into a situation where if you just play along, if you play Apple's game the way they want you to play it, your life just gets easier. And you may say, oh, well, this app, you know, iPhoto doesn't have this thing that I really like, and I just don't know if I could do it. You know, but trust me, if you play along, you'll get a ton of other things that are just really, really awesome integrations and just great support. And,
exactly.
You know, and in a way, yeah, you're kind of, it is a compromise. You're kind of giving in, you're swimming, you know, you're swimming downstream or whatever the expression is for that. But you're not really, generally, especially in this case, I'm finding I just love it. You can just, every time, it's that way I know that every single picture that I'm taking, even if I'm just syncing up my iPhone, that all of the pictures that I took on there, I can bring those in too, and they're all in one place. It's not like I have to jump around. And yeah, I mean, I know you can do that with Lightroom,
too.
But videos too. It's so seamless.
Lightroom's video support is embarrassing.
I agree. I'm glad you said that.
It's like, for those who don't know, when you import from an iPhone and so you have like a bunch of photos and a couple of videos, first of all, if you have any screenshots saved or anything that's a PNG file, Lightroom will show a dialogue saying, these files are not images and therefore can't be imported. And it's a list of all the PNGs. So that's problem number one, which is stupid. I mean, why? So that's problem number one. And then it imports the movies, but when only the most recent version, I think it's 3, of Lightroom supports even having movies in the library. But it doesn't do anything to them. It doesn't even play them in line in the preview window. What it does is it shows like a preview frame of it. And then you have to like open it, and then you hit the space bar or whatever, and then it just opens up a QuickTime window of that movie. Like it opens the QuickTime app,
yeah,
just with that movie, and then you have to play it from there. So you have like the preview shot in the background, QuickTime window that you then have to also click play on. So it's like four keystrokes or clicks to get a movie to play, and it's like it's totally disconnected from. It's like there's no reason to do this. It's such an afterthought.
Yeah,
you could tell they bolted this on with like weeks to go on the project. And so I just feel like the way I use it has diverged so far from where I was when I switched away from iPhoto. As you said, like now I think I have to switch back. So I'll probably just wait until I'll probably do it sometime soon.
So we got to take time to talk about the Macs too.
Yeah. So I'm sorry for the lack of developer related topics in this show.
Is that what people tune in for? Do you think people tune in just for the?
I think some. I'm going to do my best Dan Benjamin imitation.
Oh, great.
All right, this is cool. So I like these guys. All right. This episode of Build and Analyze is brought to you by Careers 2.0. Careers 2.0 is a new service provided by our friends at Stack Overflow. Of course, you're probably all familiar with Stack Overflow, the online Q&A resource dedicated specifically to programmers and programming-related topics. Well, the team at Stack Overflow created the Careers 2.0 service to provide you with access to great jobs and also introduce you to a bunch of great companies you might consider working for, even if you're not currently looking for a job. Think of Careers 2.0 as a programmer profile that gives you a platform to show you're awesome by featuring your proudest contributions to Stack Overflow, GitHub, SourceForge, Bitbucket, anything programming related. You can even add your favorite programming books from Amazon.com. Profiles on Careers 2.0 are free, and they are easy to get started, especially by importing your LinkedIn profile. However, there is one catch. Are you ready for this?
I am ready.
Profiles on Careers 2.0 are invite only. They did this to keep out the spam and create a high-quality environment. Fortunately for you, as a Build and Analyze listener, I've already invited you to join the tens of thousands of other programmers who already have a profile. So head on over to careers.stackoverflow.com/BA to accept your invitation today. Once again, that is careers.stackoverflow.com/BA.
BA, like B.A. Baracus from the A-Team.
Right, or like Build and Analyze.
Oh,
or
is that, maybe that's where they got that from.
Well, they didn't. It's not B-A-A or B lowercase a, capital A. It's right. Just B-A, so it could be Build And or Build Analyze.
Okay.
Yeah, no, they're cool. I did this. I went and signed up, because even though I'm not looking for a job, please don't email me asking me if I want a job. Thank you. I don't. But
like when people email you about a job, Do you like write back to them and say like, don't you know who I am, or I'm kind of a big deal?
No, I guess don't respond. Usually it's you know, pretty close to spam.
So I before we talk about these computers, thanks again to Stack Overflow. Love those.
Well,
guys.
And also with this, I wanted to say that this wasn't on their thing, but I did want to say, I went on there and created my profile here. And what I love about this, the world of hiring for programmers is so bad. Generally speaking, it's, you have like HR departments doing keyword scans for acronyms and resume databases. It's horrible. What this is, like, when I put in my profile and I put in on things I liked, I put in coffee, and things I didn't like, I put in bad coffee. It isn't showing those. So I wonder if it just shows recognized. Oh, there it is. It's there now. It must have been just cached. Oh, awesome. All right. So it's careers.stackoverflow.com/Marco Arment. And what I like about this, when you're filling out the profile, you can really see that these people are programmers. Like, they
right,
get
they get it.
It's very obvious. Like, it's not, they're not just building some big database to be keyword scanned by people who don't give a crap about programming. Like, they obviously are programmers and they get it. And if you've ever tried to get a job in the programming world, which most of listeners probably have, you know how incredibly horrible this is otherwise.
Yeah.
It's a miserable state of affairs to either hire someone or to be hired in this field. And this is a huge step forward in the right direction. And so I like these guys, and so they're awesome.
They are awesome. So it's now time, I think, to turn a little bit toward the other announcements that came out, which are the new hardware.
Yes, so this is important. So let's start with the easy one. They killed the plastic book.
They killed it.
Oh, well.
Killed it.
Gone.
It's gone. Yeah.
Well, technically, yeah. It's still being sold to educational institutions, kind of like the EMAC, I think. If anybody even remembers that.
Yeah, like kids would get the plastic ones, right?
Well, so here's a question. So they killed the plastic book, right? The plastic book was not a terrible computer. And the bigger point is, it wasn't that different from the 13-inch MacBook Pro.
They are pretty sturdy. I mean, they're almost indestructible. Like, they crack a little bit, but they hold together.
Right, yeah. The big problem is that the casing just gets discolored so badly after a while. Even, like, the first version, the very first white MacBook, the very first Intel white MacBook in 2006, I had that one. It was a great computer.
It was great.
But it had this one flaw, which is the wrist rest would get discolored very, very easily from just common like hand oils and just common usage. And even if you put protectors over it, like I had these like,
it's nasty,
clear things to put over it, even then it would get discolored from heat.
Yeah, and you know what happened to mine is right under that wrist rest. Not only did it get discolored, but there was a little crack that happened right at the base of it, where your arm, where your forearm would kind of touch. That cracked, right. And then you get cracks all over. Faith has one of these. She shows up with this thing, and it's from 2007. I'm like, what? What is that?
Is that even allowed in your house now?
I couldn't. I had no choice. I had to let her bring it in because I didn't have a new machine for her, which is why I've been talking about getting this MacBook Air all this time, because at my debate, maybe this is a good segue to start about this. My debate was, Faith needs a computer because she's going to be doing audio editing. She's going to be doing we're doing a lot more video stuff. She can do Final Cut Pro. She does all this production stuff. So she needs a decent machine to do it with. So the dilemma was, do I get her like an iMac? And we've talked about the upsides and downsides of these things. Or do I give her what has basically been my main machine? What is it, about a 2 month old, fully maxed out MacBook Pro? And
that's an awesome machine.
It's a great machine, and it's got the high res screen. And I'm thinking, you know, this machine, the advantages of this is if she has something like this, she'll have no excuse that, oh, I couldn't edit the show or whatever. I mean, she always can edit it because she can edit it anywhere she is. If we do a live thing, if we go somewhere, if we record go to somebody's place and record them there, we can bring it with us. It could be the workhorse machine that travels everywhere. So it made sense for her to have that. So all this time I've been hoping, you know, part of my excitement and hope for the new MacBook Airs coming out was because she needs a machine, you know, she needs something to use because she rolls in here with this 07 white MacBook. The thing could barely launch the mail app. It barely can launch it.
Is that even legal to operate? Like, do you have to get like emissions checks on that?
You might. So I'm looking at it, I'm like, God, I could get something. So I finally pulled. So yesterday, you know, one of the big announcements was, yes, that the white MacBook got killed. They had the Mac Mini, which the new Mac Mini.
I want to talk about that too. The Mac Mini, I think, looks pretty good.
It looks great without a DVD slot on the front of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, so that's the big thing is they dropped the optical slot. And of course it supports Thunderbolt. I think it looks really nice. It's all the, you know, the metal enclosure that I think they had that last time too, but it looks really, really nice and it's pretty fast, and they have a dual hard drive option, although it's SSD plus hard drive, I don't know. It looks really good. I was thinking like a good setup might be, because, you know, I've been thinking what to do, obviously, for my future setup.
Yeah.
Because I have this 4-year-old or almost 4-year-old Mac Pro, and I figure if this ever dies, what am I going to replace it with? And I've been planning on replacing it with a laptop, with that 15-inch that you have there. My thinking there being, most of the time I'm using it at my desk.
Right.
But I do still need to own a laptop for travel.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been doing the Mac Pro plus MacBook Air thing for a while, but what if I just did a 15-inch? Because it would be fast enough and you know, awesome enough to use as my only computer at my desk most of the time, but I could then bring it with me during the relatively rare times that I need to bring it with me.
This 15-inch MacBook Pro is the best Mac I've ever owned, and I've owned quite awesome. A few since 1984.
And so my dilemma, though, is that, you know, a laptop doesn't have as many hard drive slots on it, and so it's lower hard drive capacity, lower RAM capacity, but that doesn't matter as much. But I really I love having the Mac Pro be always on, and it is my home server. It serves my files. It serves, like, when I'm traveling, I leave it on so I can remote log in and get files off of it. It serves the Apple TV with its library of things that it plays. And you know, so it has the iTunes serving ability. So all of that is very, very useful to me. And it also receives occasional backups from Instapaper. Like I have my computer download them to itself periodically, so that I have another copy of an even safer backup. It's big enough that I have a very clean desk. I have my Time Machine drive is internal in the Mac Pro. I have tons of space. I have 2 terabytes of regular space, which I can easily expand if I need to, because disks are so cheap these days. And plus all the backups and everything. I have online backup in addition to all that for more backups. And I can have a whole. I do have a whole copy of the Instapaper database instantiated and running in MySQL on my Mac Pro, which is awesome for development. I have my own test environment here, including a whole test database, which is fantastic. And so I do have a lot of value in having a computer at home that is always going to be here, always going to be on, always reachable. Oh, and also I have it record radio shows. I have it scheduled with Audio Hijack Pro to record radio shows. Like it does a lot of kind of home server type.
Right. Not the kind of things you would want to do with a portable as much.
Yeah. And like then, because one of the downsides of it is that I can never really put this machine to sleep. It's always doing stuff.
Yeah.
So it wastes a lot of electricity and, you know, generates some heat. So that's a downside to this way. So I was thinking one good thing I could do in the future would be to get a laptop like your 15-inch to be like my main work machine, and then get one of these new Mac Minis to be the home server.
Yeah, that's actually what I'm planning on doing exactly.
I think it's a pretty popular setup among geeks like us. I mean, I've heard a lot of people always doing this over the years ever since the Mini came out.
I'm actually planning on doing it with the previous generation of Mac Mini, just because I have one of those. But they're great. They're great for all that. And that's the thing. That was my decision. I'll give Faith this monster machine.
Mm-hmm.
And all I'll have at home, all I'll have in the house, the only other machine, my wife has her laptop. I'll have the Air, brand new Air. And I'll just put a Mac Mini and I'll put a screen on it. And all of this stuff you want, and this is, again, this goes back to iPhoto. My wife doesn't want to mess around with Lightroom or Aperture. She just wants iPhoto. So we can put one library there. So what that means is we have one thing that has all of our music shared. We can sync all of our iPhones to it. We can get all of our pictures in one place. Doesn't matter who takes them or what device. They're all in one place, but one place to back everything up. It's the Holy Grail.
That's great.
So what do you think would be the right kind of reaction if I said to you, hey, look, you know, I got this 2-month-old MacBook Pro, totally maxed out, like it's a monster, it's the best, you know, ever. And I said, this is going to be your computer. Like, how would you react if you were like, you know, just starting out somewhere? You'd be pretty psyched, right?
That'd be incredible.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And for reference, that computer is with 2.3 CPU is the first Mac to be available that's not a Mac Pro. Beats my Mac Pro and Geekbench.
Yeah,
maybe the iMac might have done it before that, but only the recent iMac.
Yeah,
but yeah, like my Geekbench score is somewhere around 10,000. It's like 4.9s basically.
<That's> great.
It's like just under 10,000, and it's that's the first one to beat it, I think, or at least the recent iMacs would have been the first one to beat it.
Yeah,
but anyway. We need to talk about the Air. This is important.
Yes.
So what makes the Air so cool to me? So the big news, there's a new Air. It has Thunderbolt, and it has the Sandy Bridge-based CPUs.
Right, and backlit keyboard. Speeds. Don't forget the backlit keyboard.
Yeah, the backlit keyboard, I think that's a nice thing. You know, the previously, like a few years ago, when the first Air came out, at that time, the only way you could get like a pro laptop was to go 15 or 17 inch. There was no, like, they killed the 12 inch long before that, and there was no small pro laptop. So people who wanted ultimate portability smaller than the 15 inch could only get the plastic book. And it was, you know, in many ways it was a cheap machine. It had, you know, the plastic casing. It looked pretty bad after a pretty short amount of time. It didn't have the backlit keyboard, and you know, it lacked a bunch of pro features. So. Then the first generation MacBook Air came out, and one of the reasons it was such a big hit, besides its incredibly small weight and size, is that it was a pro quality machine. It had a pretty nice panel, a pretty nice monitor. It had the backlit keyboard. It was metal. It looked great. So you know the previous Air that before yesterday, the 2010 model, which I love. It's a great line. When they added the 11 inch and they redid the 13, it's a great upgrade, but it dropped the backlit keyboard, and that was like a little thing that kind of said this isn't quite as pro of a computer as it was before. And you know, to a lot of us that matters, and it's not that we can't see the keys otherwise, although sometimes it is useful, and there have been a couple of times where I missed it, but it's more like that's been a reminder in the Apple lineup for years of being a pro quality machine. And so they added it back. So that matters a lot there. Anyway, so besides that, the Thunderbolt port is important and the CPU power is important. So for the first time now, it has a really nice CPU. It's not as fast as your 15 inch. Like I think the benchmark said, and again, this is synthetic benchmark, of course, it's not representative of everything, but it's a decent barometer of somewhat relative performance. The Geekbench score on the high end, I think it might have only been the i5, but one of the high end ones they tested was in the 6,000 range, and your laptop is in the 10,000 or 11,000 range.
Right.
So, you know, just as a general point of reference, it has not nearly as much CPU power as a 15 inch MacBook Pro, but it's like 2.5 times what it had before.
Right. And
so it's a huge improvement.
What it had before wasn't bad either.
It wasn't bad. It would bog down during like Xcode compilations and
trying to convert video or something, it would bog
down. Yeah, any kind of CPU bound task. Which there aren't many of these days. So if you were just using it to browse the internet and stuff, you would never even notice. So that's one major important thing. The other though is the Thunderbolt port, and not because of why you think. What makes the Thunderbolt port so awesome is the new Cinema display yesterday. And this, even if you don't want one, this is important, and here's why. The new Cinema display they announced yesterday is the same price as the old one, $1,000, 27 inches, you know, same the 2560 across resolution. What matters a lot about it is that it uses Thunderbolt to FireWire 800 port and a Gigabit Ethernet port. See where I'm going with this?
It basically becomes any port that you need.
What this does, when you look at the Mac Mini drop the optical drive, their best-selling MacBooks, which I assume now are the Air, have no more optical drive. You know, they killed the plastic book, so that optical drive is gone. The 13-inch MacBook Pro, I still think, is a ridiculous choice these days, and so that's, and I think it's on its way out. I think a good question to ask would be why they didn't kill that, but they did kill the plastic book, because they aren't that different, really. So there's that thing to talk about. But anyway, the optical drive is clearly Apple saying it's gone. That's, it's dead to us. And they're aggressively phasing it out. I think we can say that now with the MacBook, or with the Mac Mini. I think you can safely say that they're aggressively phasing out the optical drive.
Yeah. I think John Gruber put on Daring Fireball, he said something along the lines of that, you know, the DVD drive or the optical drive is the new floppy drive. And same way that they got rid of that, they're over it. They're saying, who really does that anymore? And you know what? It's not like you can't get one. You can buy one. You can get an external one. So, it, you know, and you don't need... Here's the thing is you don't need the special Apple one, although you could certainly get the special Apple one. You don't need to get the special Apple one. You could just get the you could just go out and get a regular one, a USB DVD burner, whatever, and they're cheap. And you can go to Best Buy and buy them, and they just work typically. So it's not like Apple's saying you can't get one of these. And it's not the situation that we were in when the iMac came out and had no floppy drive, and people were like, what? Because you couldn't go out and buy a USB floppy drive, that day. They came out. They came out shortly. But if I remember right, when that thing was announced, it's not like people had those goofy, transparent, rainbow-colored floppy drives sitting on shelves in the local store like they do today with DVD, external DVD drives, which you can just go and buy for. I mean, I've seen them as low as $25-$35. You could just go and buy one, and so it's not like Apple's saying, we don't think you should do this anymore. But what they are saying is, this is not really important enough for us to include it anymore. We have the internet now.
Right. And so, yeah. So if you connect the dots here, I think, and I, again, I'm just quoting myself on a blog post, which I know is arrogant, so I'm sorry. I wrote a blog post like a year ago, basically speculating on the next 15-inch MacBook Pro and saying that, you know, they could adopt wedge shape of the Air and cut out a lot of the mass and a lot of the weight in a 15-inch line if they were able to get rid of the FireWire port and the Gigabit port. And then Thunderbolt came out a few months after that, and I was like, wow, wait a minute, that solves the problem, right? So I think if you connect the dots here, I think the next update to the 15-inch is going to be major. I think they're going to drop the optical drive, and it's going to get a wedge shape, or at least a very thin shape.
Nice prediction. So July 21st, 2011, Marco has made a prediction. The next MacBook Pro, huge, huge redo, huge change, wedge shape.
15-inch. And you know what? I wouldn't be too attached to the 13-inch Pro, because I think, although I think most people who own them now think I'm a total ass and aren't listening anymore, but... it wouldn't surprise me if a 13-inch Pro went away in that update.
Yeah. So you're saying it would go away entirely. That would be gone. And there would just be, it would basically be all just a line. All MacBooks would be Airs, basically. They would just add a 15, they would just add a 15-inch Air, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, I think the 17 will still continue to be the aircraft carrier that it is today.
Right.
Which is, you know, that's where they shove all of the, like, the big needs stuff. Like, it'll probably keep its optical drive longer than any other laptop will.
Right.
I think Gruber even said, like, the Mac Pro is probably going to be the last computer with an optical drive that Apple sells.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, by the way, remember that didn't happen? The Mac Pro updates that were supposed to happen? That didn't happen.
No, it did not happen.
Anyway. So I think whenever the 15-inch is updated next, which is probably, I don't know, the current one is, what, about 4 months old now? I think they came out in February. So maybe, so usually that's like 9 to 15 months. So probably like this winter or this spring, there's like this coming winter, this coming spring, there's probably going to be a major MacBook Pro update.
I like this. You're going on record.
Yeah, because I have zero information, and this is 100% speculation. But I just think if you connect the dots, I think they've removed a lot of the reasons why that couldn't or shouldn't exist.
Right.
Like why, like effectively a 15-inch Air. And one of the reasons the 15-inch is so much bigger and heavier is because it has a much bigger battery, and batteries are heavy, and there's not really much you can do about that. You know, if you need that much power, you have to have a big battery. So I don't expect the weight to change a lot. Like, I don't think it's not going to go to 3 pounds or anything. But currently it's like 5.6. If they get rid of the glass screen and do just like a plastic glossy like the Air or a matte like they offer now, they can – they do that, drop the optical, you know, drop the make the wedge shape thinner, so drop some of the aluminum in the body. I think they could probably get it down to at least maybe 4.5, dropping a pound off of it basically. I bet they could do that and still have a 15-inch size screen, the full keyboard, still have the exact same footprint basically, and just have it be thinner, get rid of that sharp edge in the front, which I hate, and I think that's that could really happen now, and maybe it's 4.5, 4.6 pounds. Which is currently the 13 inches weight.
Mm.
What do you think? You think it's possible to do that so soon?
I don't think we'll see it that soon. I almost feel like they want to let things settle down for a while with the Airs. I don't know.
When has Apple ever let things settle down?
Well, I mean, they are actually, you're right. I mean, generally they don't. There was actually an article, I'm trying to remember where I saw it. I'm sure John Gruber linked to it, but I'm trying to remember where I saw it originally. But I'm sure the link is on Daring Fireball now if you go there. But the article essentially was talking about how Apple may have sold more phones, more iPhones, by not updating it, by giving it a slower update cycle and pushing out the update. They may have sold more than they otherwise would have. And, you know,
I think that was an AIMCO post.
Okay, that's what it was. And I feel like, you know, if they do the same thing with this Air, I think tons and tons and tons of people are going to buy these 13-inch Airs. I think the 11-inch Air is a special case. I think that's for somebody who wants something that's super ultra portable. I think
honestly, I think they're going to sell a ton. I think
they'll sell a lot.
It's going to sell more than the 13.
You do? Okay. So we're on.
Because it's cheaper and it's a lot cooler in the store.
It is pretty darn cool in the store. But I don't know. I still think the 13, because I think now with the white book going away, the replacement for that machine is some people still, well, I don't want an 11-inch screen. It's too small. There's a lot of people who will say that. Maybe not a lot of the cool kids and the rock stars, but I think there's a lot of people who are going to college or people who don't have, you know, 20-year-old eyes who are going to say that's the right form factor for me. That's the right size for me. Oh, I really wanted a 13-inch. And then I could see the 13-inch MacBook Pro just sort of slowly going away as the MacBook Airs 13 inches get faster. And I could really imagine an 11 and a 13-inch MacBook Air, 15-inch MacBook Pro, and a 17-inch MacBook Pro as the only machines they even make. That's my...
You're saying they dropped the 13 Air?
No, they dropped the 13 MacBook Pro.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that makes sense.
I'm saying have four... Apple makes four laptops, period. The 11 and 13 right. Airs and the 15 and 17 Pros. And
you can predict Apple's product eliminations pretty easily, because if you look at... Like, Apple likes having a nice, clean lineup. They like there being very few options, and that for every... for every person's needs to be very easily answered by one computer in the lineup.
Right.
Like... Right now, the way the 13-inch Pro is and the way the plastic book was until yesterday, those kind of sat in weird spots that had a lot of overlap with the Airs.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a weird situation. They ironed that out partially by killing the 13-inch plastic. And it just follows that they're probably going to kill the 13-inch Pro next.
Right.
And I think you're right. I think a year from today, the lineup is 11-inch and 13-inch Airs, exactly what you said. 11, 13 Air, 15 Pro, 17 Pro. That's it.
And you know what that is? We got to wrap. We got to do it.
Yeah, we're good.
All right, Marco, you have a great week.
You too.
All right, take care. And so that is it for today's episode. We want to make sure that we say thanks to our two regular network sponsors, the Omni Group and also Harvest. I want to mention Stack Overflow again. Go check them out. The links are right there on the show page. And we appreciate you stopping by. Go to 5x5.tv. You can hear older episodes of this show and all the other shows that we do. And of course, if you like the show, please consider rating it on iTunes. That helps us out a lot. We'll be back again next week. Thanks for tuning in.